Bikescapers, this is Bikescape, the podcast that talks about bikes, the people that ride them, the places they go on their bikes, and the things they think about when they're riding them. And this week we're going to talk about peak oil. It's not a pleasant subject, but it's a subject that has to be thought about and hopefully acted upon once we figure out what we're going to do about it. That's what we examine here on Bikescape. It's one of the, we look at all the angles. So, this week we have an interview with, author James Howard Kunstler, author of The Long Emergency, a new book that he's just written about, peak oil. He's also written, The Geography of Nowhere about suburbia and how it came to be that way and what's wrong with it, And that was a book that really informed my thinking over the years, and a lot of my friends as well. Highly recommend you reading it. And anyway, peak oil is what happens when you've used up half the oil in the world, and now we're going to use the other half. And the other half is going to get used up a lot faster than the first half. So without further ado, I'm going to cut this podcast. I'm going to not do the community calendar section that I usually do at the end, because I don't want this to go over too far. This is a half-hour interview, and it's chock full of all sorts of great stuff. So let's get to it. We're here with James Howard Kunstler. I'll call you Jim if you don't mind.
No, that's fine.
I was going to start out by reading this two-page ad, center spread in today's San Francisco Chronicle. From the Chevron Corporation. It says, it took us 125 years to use the first trillion barrels of oil, and we'll use the next trillion in 30. And then there's a letter on the second page from David J. O'Reilly, chairman and CEO of the Chevron Corporation, and he says, energy will be one of the most defining issues of this century. One thing is clear, the era of easy oil is over. What we do next will determine how we meet the energy needs of the entire world this century and beyond. Demand is soaring like never before, and as populations grow and economies take off, millions in the developing world are enjoying the benefits of a lifestyle that requires increasing amounts of energy. In fact, some say that in 20 years, the world will consume 40% more oil than it does today. At the same time, many of the world's oil and gas fields are maturing, and the new energy discoveries are mainly occurring in places where resources are difficult to extract physically, economically, and even politically. When growing demand meets tighter supplies, the result is more competition for the same resources. We can wait until a crisis forces us to do something, or we can commit to working together and start by asking the tough questions. How do we meet the energy needs of the developing world and those of the industrialized nations? What role will renewables and alternative energies play? And what's the best ways to protect our environment? How do we accelerate our conservation efforts? What actions do we take, and we must not look to the next year, but to the next 50 years. And it goes on with a spiel for Chevron. But this is coming up from Chevron, and that pretty much explains, without actually using the words peak oil, what's going on. And everybody seems to know what peak oil is these days, but you've sort of distilled it and analyzed the consequences. And you call the consequences the long emergency. That's the title of your new book. So I wonder if you could start out by explaining in short order what the long emergency means to you.
The long emergency is an interval of time without any necessary horizon. We don't really know whether it will be 5 years or 20 years or 100 years or 1,000 years, after which we will have to, during which we will have to contend with a much scarcer energy economy and world. You know, the Chevron ad in the newspaper really just represents the idea, as they used to say back in the space age, that Houston, we've got a problem.
Right. Yeah. It seems that if they're actually coming out and saying this in a two-page spread, then they're cranking up the political machinery to do something. When you say that there's going to be a long emergency, we're talking about years of change, and we're we spent the last 50 years building up to a certain infrastructure in this country, and how is that going to have to change now?
Well, we're simply not going to be able to live in the drive-in utopia that we have squandered our resources on, namely the suburban living arrangement, which I've been writing about for about 15 years, and which I define as the greatest misallocation of resources in the history of the world, a place that has very poor prospects for the future. So circumstances are going to be telling us very clearly that we have to really radically change. Hello?
I'm here.
Are you hiccuping back there?
I'm here. I can hear you.
We're going to have to radically change, resize, downscale all of the common activities of American life, especially the way we grow food and where we do it. Farming is something, you know, the industrial farming method that we have arrived at, it really is probably not going to survive the disruptions of the 21st century. And we're going to have to grow a lot more of our food close to home. And it is liable to involve a lot of human labor. All these things have tremendous social and political implications, as well as implications for simply how we get by.
So the era of the agribusiness where so I won't be able, you're telling me I won't be able to get my bananas from Guatemala anymore, or
as well, as you know, they're still going to be trade. I can't say for sure that we won't be trading things from even from as far away as Central America, but you're probably not going to be living on a diet of cheese doodles and dip made from one factory in Wisconsin or California. And probably if we, if we're going to have any economy at all, agriculture is going to come much more to the center of that economy. But it's really hard to say how that will happen because of the implications for political turbulence. You know, all these questions about how we reallocate the land that we have. We've been furiously damaging our rural land in America for 50 years or more. The subdivision practices of the 20th century were tremendously destructive. There are a lot of cities in America that don't even have any of their agricultural hinterland remaining because they've all been suburbanized. And a lot of these places are going to be in big trouble. I have predicted in my book, The Long Emergency, that the industrial cities of America are probably going to contract severely. And I think they will do so in a particular way. I think they will tend to re-densify near their centers at the same time that they are becoming smaller metropolitan areas and probably more compact. Of course, that raises the question of what happens to these asteroid belts of suburbia that are around all of our cities. And I think the answer is they lose their value. They become, to one degree or another, things that people want to abandon. And it's not going to be pretty. One of the consequences of having misallocated so much of our resources in this infrastructure for daily life is the fact that it will stimulate a psychology of previous investment, which is another way of saying that you put so much of your resources in a certain set of hardware or infrastructure that you can't imagine letting go of it or changing it or reforming it. And so to some degree or other, suburbia is liable to remain a tremendous problem for us, a tremendous liability as people struggle to deal with it. And some people will choose to leave it. Some people will choose to sell it while they can get out. I think there will be an increasingly diminishing pool of buyers for it. And it's going to represent, in the aggregate, a tremendous loss of hallucinated wealth.
Hallucinated wealth, yeah, that's a good way to describe it. You know, we're, this podcast is called Bikescape, and we talk to bicyclists.
What is it called?
Bikescape. And our audience is mostly bicyclists and activist uh-huh. bicyclists who, and mm-hmm. in my work, you know, as a bicycle activist, I find myself arguing like crazy, you know, in front of City Hall, in front of Board of Supervisors and City Councils and whatnot to get a bike lane and or to get some kind of walking facilities in my town. And
well, for the most part, municipal officials are not interested in that.
Yeah, it's been a little better the last few years after lots of radical activism. You know, we've been out in the streets here in San Francisco here. Yeah. But the kind of rebuilding that's necessary, and the thing that we always come up against is people, when you talk about, what was the phrase you used, already paid for infrastructure, it happens on a personal level. People have paid for their cars, and they do not want to give them up, even in the city here.
Right, and the sum of all those decisions and the sum of all those investments is tremendous.
Yeah.
You know, it represents a tremendous amount of cultural inertia.
Yeah, it represents the American dream, the manifest destiny. the problem that we run into politically is that the supervisors and from the president down to the city council to the planning commission, they don't want to hear what we're talking about because it's just politically not popular. And why is it that politicians can't approach this issue?
Well, it's a good question, and I think part of the answer lies in this direction, that the dirty secret of the American economy is that it has become utterly dependent on the creation of ever more suburban sprawl and all of its accessories. And if you remove those activities from our economy, there isn't a whole lot left besides fried chicken, hair cutting, and open heart surgery. And so no politician, including the politicians from my party, which, you know, I'm a registered Democrat, nobody wants to touch that issue, which is to say explicitly, of informing the American people that we can no longer afford to have an economy based mostly on that activity. It is a suicidal economy. And yet, you know, if you remove it, you're removing about half of the economy, so nobody wants to talk about it because, you know, you're basically saying, you know, we have to stop the home builders and the highway guys and the people who build all the strip malls and all the job opportunities that come from the Walmart and the Target store. So really, this is, you know, something interesting is happening politically, though, and it's not necessarily a good thing, but I will point it out to you. There's a new party forming in England called the British National Party, and it has a very robust agenda that recognizes our the path that we are on with energy and the problems that we are going to encounter and all of the implications. It's a very, very smart agenda. The trouble is that this is something of a fascist party. I think that you will see something similar happen in the United States, and it is precisely because we are getting such poor leadership from our traditional political parties, the Republicans and Democrats, that in the vacuum of their impotence and ineffectualness, something else is going to arise to take their place, you know, something that promises action. And I'm afraid that it's going to be a form of what I call cornpone fascism. Mm. So we're already seeing that in England. And one of the interesting aspects of the British National Party is that they expect that their strength is going to grow very quickly as people begin to discover that they have been poorly prepared for this energy debacle by the traditional parties. And I think that something similar could happen in the United States. We could enter this new political cycle of authoritarian fascism rather quickly. And it's not going to come from the traditional centers of power. This is something that I disagree with my friends. You know, my friends are all wringing their hands over George Bush. And I think that what we may get is going to make George Bush look very mild in comparison.
Yeah, maybe these are the people that Chevron is talking to in their ad.
Well, who knows? I hasten to add that I am generally allergic to conspiracy theories, And what I am saying here is not a conspiracy theory. It is simply stating a possible political scenario, which is not much different from what happened in Weimar Germany in the late 1920s and early 30s. Namely, that you had a political establishment that was not capable of dealing with the realities of the time. And they were eclipsed by a powerful fascist movement. We're setting ourselves up for that kind of thing. I firmly believe that the Republican Party is going to be discredited by the events that we're facing and by what will prove to be their failure to prepare the public for these events.
Yeah, that's not the kind of talk that makes you popular at parties.
Well, what does that mean? Does that mean that you're not willing to discuss it, or do you find
it crazy, or would you not talk
to your friends about it? I think it's important.
Yep.
Maybe you ought to consider it an important subject for parties.
It's a very important subject. I didn't mean to imply that. But yeah.
No, but you know, you said something interesting, and what you're doing, I think, is admitting a kind of ineffectualness of your own political position, and that's not a good thing. You know, we need something that will be an effective counter to authoritarian fascism. And you saying that this is not an apt subject for cocktail parties is not a good start.
I'll tell you what my strategy is, and let me see what you think about it. I think what we need to do is find a way to this whole the fascist tendencies are all aided and embedded by the alienation that comes from suburban life, from driving in cars, all listening to the same.
Well, it doesn't help, that's for sure.
It does, yeah.
I think it comes mostly from a sense of impotence and from a sense that events are overtaking us.
Right.
I hasten to point out, though, that there's going to be a tremendous battle to sustain the entitlements of suburbia on the part of the people who enjoy it currently.
Right.
And, I think that, if anything, that this kind of fascism will arise out of suburbia, perhaps.
Right. So an antidote might be, then, to create a community to try and commit. Those of us who ride bicycles here in the city, we see the same people every day, and after 10 years of riding in the city, you start seeing that you start knowing people that ride bicycles. We create a community.
I hear people talk about creating communities a lot because my first three books were kind of about that subject.
It's a reaction.
And, I really have to make a distinction between, a real community and just a gathering of people who enjoy a particular activity. That's not a community. That's just a gathering of like-minded hobbyists. And one of the things that's facing us that's very troublesome is the need to reestablish real communities based on economic interdependency and roles in the community that are both social and economic, not just roles that revolve around a certain passion or hobby or activity. And it's a huge task that faces us, and I don't know whether we're going to be able to do it or not.
What are the forces that govern these dynamics? How do you create an interdependent community in this?
Well, I think that societies are to a large extent self-organizing. They exhibit what we have come to call emergent behavior. They self-organize according to the circumstances that they take place in. Suburbia was to a large degree a self-organizing way of life, due largely to the availability of a lot of cheap oil for a long time, and also to a long period of relative world peace. The economies and communities of the future will self-organize around the imperatives of the time. I happen to think that many of them will form around agriculture. And we will see, for example, a reversal of the population trends of the last 200 years. Namely, we will see people inclining to move back to smaller towns and places that are proximate to viable agriculture and moving away from bigger cities and suburban metroplexes and gigantic conurbations. And the economies of the later on in the 21st century will probably form around these agricultural communities and the activities that support them.
What about in cities, in urban situations? What do you think there?
I think American cities are going to contract, as I said earlier. And I think they will contract severely. And they will redensify their centers, but they will contract on the whole. Our cities are where they are because they occupy important sites. San Francisco occupies an important geographic site. It's on a peninsula that sticks out into a very good sheltered harbor or bay. It's an enormous geographical feature. You know, Detroit exists where it does for a particular reason. It's on a strategic river between two great lakes. St. Louis is where it is because it's where the Mississippi and the Missouri meet. So you have these cities. We are not going to reenact the 20th century. We're not going to see the rise of the industrial city happen all over again. We're going to see something else. I think the cities, something will be in these places, probably substantial settlements, but they will not be the kind of industrial metropolises, metropoli, that we know today. They will be different. And the cities that are the most burdened by skyscrapers and megastructures will probably be the places in the most trouble. Because I think we will have a lot of trouble running megastructures and skyscrapers in an energy-scarce future.
I guess the most
Yeah, I don't take progressivism that seriously from any sector in America because much of it has its head up its ass. Including the urban planners who I am deeply familiar with from having written three books about urban planning. The last thing that we're going to need is megastructures and skyscrapers.
I guess the most progressive urban planners here in San Francisco have been pushing lately for high-density towers.
I don't take progressivism that seriously from any sector in America because much of it has its head up its ass. Including the urban planners who I am deeply familiar with from having written three books about urban planning. The last thing that we're going to need is megastructures and skyscrapers.
So how in the best case scenario, how would you like to see a city? What should we be doing politically now to change our cities to mitigate the future problems that we're going
to? Hard to say what we should be doing politically because, in fact, the politics will be a response to what we have to do. And what we have to do and what we have to prepare for is the contraction of our larger cities. One of the things that I think we can say very clearly is that we desperately need to restore the American passenger railroad system.
Right.
We have a railroad system that the Bulgarians would be ashamed of. And we have to do better. We desperately need this, and we needed it yesterday. It is the one thing we could do that would mitigate to a significant extent our egregious oil use, our tremendous oil consumption. It's the one thing that we could do that we know how to do that doesn't require something to be reinvented or invented from the ground up, like fusion. It would give Americans a lot of confidence if they could accomplish this, and they can accomplish it. But I think it is a very serious indication of how clueless we are that nobody at either end of the political spectrum is talking about reviving the American railroad system. And this is one of the things that makes me believe that progressives are not very serious people these days.
What about transit and walkable?
Well, transit is only a subcategory of the railroads. You know, public transit can include all of those things, but you know, it's one part of this of the system of railroads. When you have a public transit system that is a robust one, it operates on all levels. You know, from the long trips to the short connections once you get to your destination, and of course, one of the worst parts of our current system is that even if you did take a train from Chicago to Louisville, if you could, there's probably no way you could get from the train station to the place that you finally have to go. And of course we're going to need those things. And we had a wonderful light rail or interurban trolley system in America for about 40 years, from about 1890 to about 1830, and then we allowed it to be systematically destroyed. And that was our choice, by the way. You know, being allergic to conspiracy theories, my tendency is always to blame the American people for a lot of their own problems. You know, it's not a conspiracy that people are living in suburbia, and it's not a conspiracy that we tore up the streetcar systems of America, which took so many resources to build in the first place, and work so wonderfully well. You know, we're going to need to replace them. I don't know if we're going to be able to. I don't know if we will have the resources to do that. We may be a considerably less affluent people in the next 40 years than we have been.
Right now we're fighting on the little things, like this Home Depot that wants to come into San Francisco.
Oh, yeah, and this is bullshit because, you know, these things are going to disappear very, very much on their own. The national chain retail scene is really pretty doomed, and I know that people have a hard time believing that because they see these things being so successful and replicating themselves all over the landscape. But, you know, they are following the logic of a cancer disease. And they may be replicating themselves now, and they may seem to be very successful, but they are not going to survive the energy disruptions and problems of the next 20 years. And they're going to go down very hard and very fast on their own. They're not going to be able to run those warehouses on wheels. And they're not going to be able to access those 12,000-mile manufacturing supply lines to China, especially when we are contesting with China over the remaining oil resources in the world. So that's something that is going
to
probably take care of itself, and something that I would not necessarily recommend that people waste their energy over.
Well, it seems like what they do is they divide the community, and you know they're the people that want to have a walkable community where, you know, without a huge big box with parking lot, and then there's another group of people in a different neighborhood who are looking forward to the jobs they think will result from this, and it's
oh yeah, there's no question that, you know, on the whole, the American public has welcomed the onslaught of national chain retail. Now, the truth is, and it's a somewhat unappetizing truth. The truth is that a lot of that sentiment has come from the lower middle class, and a lot of it is erroneous anyway. You know, they have lobbied for Walmart on the grounds that they can save $7 on a hairdryer, you know. But the fact is, while they're saving $7 on a hairdryer, they're destroying the social cohesion and the economic strength of their local communities. And so it's been a very bad bargain for them. Unfortunately, they've been hornswoggled by the public relations divisions of these powerful companies into thinking that it's good for them. And it's, you know, it points up to something else that is very important that Americans have a hard time understanding, and that is that life is tragic. Life is tragic, and history doesn't care if we make a lot of stupid mistakes.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the kind of stupid mistake and foolish behavior that we have allowed ourselves to follow. And, you know, we have only ourselves to blame for it.
Right. So that's what we have to turn around, is on an individual basis. How do we go about educating people in a way that they can start out? There's got to be a friendly way of educating people and getting people to...
That's something that a lot of people hope, that there's a friendly, painless way to educate people. And, you know, I don't know if that's true. I wrote a book in an attempt to do it, and it certainly was a very painful process to write that book. Believe me, it was a bummer. And, you know, and I did it, and it's done. If people want to read it, they can read it. But it's a little Boy Scoutish, I think, to hope that Americans are just going to get smart about this stuff overnight. I don't think they will. I think we're sleepwalking into the future. I think that we're going to get clobbered when we get there. And we're probably, we're not going to wake up overnight and do anything intelligent.
Okay. Well, I just want to go back to creating community again. What do you think are the forces that govern the creation of community in this country? How would you create an interdependent? I mean, I know it's not you don't want to have people surrounding, you know, brought together by, you know, bicycles or hobbies or anything, but or even lifestyles. But how would you go about creating an economically?
It's not something you go about. I mean, this is the major delusion that I think that is inherent in your question. The idea that you go about this in some kind of a conscious way. You don't. You know, what happens is that you live in a society that responds to the conditions of life of the time that you're living, and you really follow the imperatives of your time. And what we are going to follow is a tremendous need to do things differently, a mandate. The future will compel us to live differently, whether we like it or not.
We're going to have to work.
And then there will be sets of individual choices that you make within that context. You know, you'll decide, for example, you know, that if you're a public relations executive, that maybe there's not going to be a whole lot of work for public relations executives because large corporations are going to wither. In fact, anything on the large, organized on a large scale is going to tend to do poorly in an energy scarce future. So maybe being a public relations executive is a bad choice. Maybe you're much better off being a paramedic or learning something about taking care of sick people or nursing. Or something about growing food or agriculture or the activities associated with it. Those are the kinds of choices that are going to matter, the choices that people make about where they're going to live. You know, people decide. I hear people every day tell me they're planning to move to Phoenix, you know. I can't imagine a worse choice, except maybe Las Vegas. Those places are going to get hammered in an energy-scarce future. They are going to be substantially depopulated. They will be uninhabitable.
What would be a good choice? Where would be a good place to move?
Well, as I said earlier, to find a smaller town or a smaller city in a place that is near viable agriculture. Those are the kind, and believe me, that's exactly what you don't get in Phoenix and Las Vegas.
Yeah.
So those are self-evidently the kinds of places that are not going to do well. And I think it's self-evident what the kinds of places that will do well are.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I really
You're welcome.
Taking the time to talk to a little podcast like Bikescape. And I'll make sure it gets around. And I appreciate
Okay.
Appreciate your help.
Sure.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You very much. So that was James Howard Kunstler, ladies and gentlemen. Well, that was thought-provoking. I'm convinced that those of us who are the true Bikescapers out there, those of you who have been listening since the beginning to the Bikescape the last 6 months, have a good idea of what I mean when I say bicycling promotes culture and community. And what I'm trying to do with this Bikescape podcast is take the bicycle cult and turn it into true bicycle culture and bring it to the mainstream, because I hope a lot of you think that, you know, bicycling is, for some it's a hobby, but for those of us who use it as transportation to get around, as a way of life, I think all of us know that if more people rode bicycles in the city would be a better place, and in the suburbs as well. It's possible to live car-free in the suburbs. Ask Cash from a few podcasts back. You get the feeling when you ride a bicycle, it's so different from riding in a car. You're out there, you're among the elements, you're one with nature, you're one with the road, with gravity, with hills and wind, and you're also one with the people around you. And you talk to other bicyclists, you talk to people in cars even sometimes, rarely because they usually have their windows closed with the air conditioning on and radio on. But it's such a contrast from the traffic jam out on the freeway with people sitting in their cars, all listening to the same radio station with the windows closed, all having the same thoughts and all bored out of their minds. What an existence, you know? It's just, what have we come to? And I would like to try and reverse that, and I don't think it's too late. And if nothing else, creating some kind of bicycle community followed by a walkable community, it might inspire someone who's engaged in food, in the food industry or food production or food growing, to create something along those lines for people who are interested in food. It's time for a podcast called Foodscape, for instance. And people need to be thinking about ways to grow huge amounts of food in the cities. And there may not be enough land to grow it the way we're growing it now, but there are theories out there, there are thoughts, there are inventions. People, you know, I'm not saying we can solve everything with technology, but I do think that there are ways to turn warehouses into multi-tiered, you know, algae farms, hydroponics, I don't know. I'm a bicyclist, this is Bikescape. I deal in transportation here. And promoting the bicycle as everyday transportation. But what we need to do is create an environment where there's a counterpoint to the kind of crypto cornpone fascism that will arise. And I think Kunstler is completely correct about that. People are very sensitive about their cars and about their ability to drive in their homes on big lots of land out in the suburbs. And they've invested a lot in them. There's commercials all the time on television. If this was on normal radio, there would be commercials on both sides, you know, advertising the latest Nissan or Chevrolet or Ford. And people are bought into it, and it's something that needs to change. And we need to provide, you and me, ladies and gentlemen, need to provide, dear listeners, we need to provide, we all have to provide some kind of counterpoint to that. Something that people can look at as an example. Not just talk, but actual action. We have to be able to see. You have to be able to look out on the streets of your city and see people getting ahead on bicycles, smiling people riding their bicycles and getting to where they need to go in a more efficient, healthy manner, and without using any oil, at least for their transportation needs. So that's the Bikescape Manifesto in a nutshell, and I hope it gets out there. And I would appreciate if you'd pass this podcast on to people and stay subscribed and tell people that we exist and that, you know, that you exist. And get out there and, as Scoop Nisker here in San Francisco says, go out and make some news of your own. If you are into food or start talking about how are we gonna grow food? How are we going to feed the people in the cities? How are we going to provide an alternative to the suburbs? Because that's what has to happen. So thanks for listening, and good night, everybody. See you next week.